It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Kevin Gavin, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. It was written in 1787, ratified by 11 states and adopted in 1789. It's the U.S. Constitution, the foundation for a new government, a new country. More than two centuries later, it remains the supreme law of the United States. Tomorrow is Constitution Day, and joining us to talk about the lasting and ongoing impact of the Constitution is University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris. David, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
It's good to be back with you.
Okay, it's considered to be the oldest single document Constitution in the world, the United Kingdom's Constitution, a collection of documents including elements of the Magna Carta, 224 years. What are some of the core elements of the Constitution that has helped it endure?
Well, it becomes obvious when you look at it, Kevin, that there are several different themes that weave through it. First, it allowed the states to continue as entities. That's what we call federalism today. So we still have a Pennsylvania, we still have an Arizona, but the federal government operates in its areas, its spheres of power, and the state operates in theirs, closer to where the people are. Separation of powers, I think, is the key to why the Constitution has survived the way it has and what it's done for us. It was not original to our founding document. This idea was floating around, but separation of powers, the idea that you have checks and balances, that power is distributed among institutions instead of concentrated in one sovereign like a king or a queen, that in a legal document, in a binding constitution, that's the first time that that really happened. And that has allowed us really to remain free as people because the powers check each other. The executive is checked by the judiciary, the legislative, and the executive sometimes tussle over things. Their powers wax and wane. Each has its own power. And then, of course, there's the Bill of Rights. That was the piece that allowed the Constitution to be passed because there were people who were not confident in having a strong central government, and the Bill of Rights guarantees individual freedoms to Americans.
Let's take some of those points, go into a little more depth. Federalism, could that have ever been a breaking point for our founding fathers, people who were concerned about the strength of a central government?
Oh, yes, because as probably you remember, there was something before our United States. That was the Articles of Confederation. Right. And that had a very weak central government. The states were still the sort of predominant government entities, and that failed. It was an utter failure. And so we needed a stronger central government, it was realized. But there were people in the states. I mean, back then, you wouldn't say you were from the United States. You would say you were from Virginia or Pennsylvania. And many people wanted the states to continue as real, honest-to-God government creatures. And because of that, there had to be a balance struck. You needed a strong central government. We saw that through the failure of the Articles of Confederation. On the other hand, the states had to have a role too. So the idea that both continue in their separate spheres, the federal government does things like the currency, the national defense, and so forth, immigration, the states have the remaining police powers, the remaining powers to see that things get done closer to the ground. That was the compromise that was struck, and you had small states, you had big states. That was another big issue. So we have a House of our Congress that's devoted to representing by a population, which favors big states, and then the Senate, which, of course, is two senators for every state, no matter how big or small.
That was the Connecticut Compromise?
That's it. That's it. That's right.
So there's a lot of foresight going on here. People dealt with arguments, very difficult questions to answer, and they got it done.
They did. And it's, when you think about that now, when you think about the historical background and you look at our own Congress, it's a little kind of disconcerting to see that they can't pass the farm bill now. And yet these folks back in 1786 and 87 were able to think through an entire republic and get it all down on paper. Now, part of the reason that they were able to do that is because they were facing an existential crisis. I mean, they had fought a war to be independent. What are we going to be after that? Another part of it is that when you draft a constitution, you're by necessity, you're drafting in general. You can't, and don't want to try to work out every possible contingency. It's general principles. So compromises are made, as we were just saying. You have big ideas that are the governing ways of looking at things and not sort of small operational details getting in the way.
Tomorrow's Constitution Day, and talking with us to discuss the enduring, the lasting impact of the U.S. Constitution is Pitt Law Professor David Harris. David, you mentioned earlier balance of powers, and this was not all that common in the world at that time. So what was the argument for this balance of powers, the separation, but this balance?
The ideas were floating around, Kevin. Montesquieu, the French philosopher, he was talking about these things. There were other nations that had legislatures and, of course, had judges. But most of these places were governed by kings and queens. And no matter what the other centers of power were, if the king wanted your head, the king got your head. Whether you were a plowman or a judge or a member of the parliament, if you were inconvenient for the king, you were gone. And so this idea that you'd have separation of powers, that power would be divided between institutions as a way of keeping any one institution from becoming too powerful. Remember, the colonists had fought a war to get rid of the king, which was an overbearing presence in the lives of too many people. They were cautious about power. They did not want a king. They did not want too much power in any one set of hands. So the idea was, if we separate powers so that they're jealous of each other, these institutions, the executive, the legislative, the judiciary, they don't all have the power to get the full job done, we, the people, will actually be freer because we will be able to steer this government more to our purposes instead of having power abused by somebody or one institution that's too powerful.
I think that transitions nicely into that fear of monarchy or concern of a monarchy developing here in this new country also led to those individual rights.
That's right. You know, if you look at the history of the individual 13 states, many of them had something that looks a lot like our Bill of Rights. I practiced in Maryland for a long time. We had articles of rights that looked a lot like the Bill of Rights. But our federal Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, it's not too much to say that without those, it's not clear we would have got the Constitution itself ratified. And so those form so much of our politics, our individual rights, the ways we live, the ways we think. It's almost unimaginable to us to think the government could tell us what to think or what to read or who can publish and who cannot and when we can assemble and petition the government. Yet those things are all things that don't exist in many other countries, even today, and they're guaranteed to us and have been so for over 200 years. It's one of the things that makes this country the place that it is. It allows the very free and open American spirit, and I say that without any irony, to sort of become what it is, because we are a free people because we can exercise those freedoms. And without the ability to exercise them, our spirit would be stunted.
Question from Chris in Moon Township emailed this in. David, he wants to know if you can name one instance, say, in the past 5 years, where civil liberties and the U.S. Constitution trumped the will of government and significantly changed its course.
Well, I can get, say, 10 or 12 years, I can give you a lot of examples. You know, we've had a lot of changes in this country after September 11th, 2001. We just passed that anniversary, of course. And in the aftermath, the executive branch grew greatly in power. And one of the things that the president and the executive branch did was they set up a brand new prison on Guantanamo Bay on Cuba. And in that prison, they were putting prisoners from all over the world, captured in what was then referred to as the global war on terror. The marching orders were no due process, no trial, no charges, no anything. There was abuse, some say even torture. Others call it enhanced interrogation techniques. A lot of this stuff was reined in through separation of powers. Some of this was by the judiciary. Lawsuits were brought about what was going on in Guantanamo. And eventually it worked its way up to the Supreme Court, where Justice O'Connor famously said, war is not a blank check for anything the executive wants to do. There has to be some due process. There has to be some semblance of our constitutional system, even in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So I think that's a great example of where pieces of the Constitution, where other branches have weighed in, where the Bill of Rights has made a big difference.
Pitt Law Professor David Harris is our guest on WESA's Essential Pittsburgh. We're talking about Constitution Day tomorrow and the enduring nature of the U.S. Constitution. There's definitely, David, a difference between an enduring document and a living document. So it's been changed just 27 times via amendment. So whether it's through the courts or the amendment process, the Constitution gives this country sort of a mulligan, a redo, a remedy?
Yeah, we get both the benefits of stability and the ability to change and fix our problems and move into new ages. The amendment process, as you said, Kevin, has been used to address new problems that come up, everything from when the president is inaugurated. President used to be inaugurated in March of each year, and it was just thought too long. A presidential term's now limited to two after Franklin Roosevelt. Prohibition, getting rid of prohibition, the income tax, all these things have come through the amendments process, women's suffrage. And those give us the flexibility to do big things, make them different when we really need to. The problem sometimes is that that's a very cumbersome and difficult process. Now, it's that way by design. We don't want to be changing so much, and that's the stability end of it. So we have to know it's like that the metaphor of the great aircraft carrier. You can turn it, but it takes a long time and a lot of effort.
So there are the individual questions that come before the U.S. Supreme Court. Is something constitutional? Is it
yes.
not? But really, is that the basic question, living or not, that sort of will answer all the other questions?
Well, it is. You know, there's a long-running argument in this country about how to interpret the Constitution, and it's really sharp in the last 20 to 30 years. On one side, you've got Justice Scalia, who talks about the Constitution as a dead Constitution. In other words, it means only what it meant when the individual piece you're talking about was ratified or passed, whatever it happens to be. And on the other end, you've got people like Justice Breyer who think the Constitution has to evolve to some extent through Supreme Court interpretation. Why? Because it's written on a general way. There was no GPS when the Supreme Court when the Fourth Amendment was passed. Yet the Supreme Court has a case on it just a year ago, where they have to decide how does that fit into Fourth Amendment search and seizure law. And so there has to be some kind of evolution as we go along. Mostly what we get is a tension on the Supreme Court and these issues that goes back and forth. Scalia saying on the one hand, no, you can't interpret it. It's got to mean exactly what it says. Otherwise, you're putting your own values into it. And that's a fair point. On the other hand, if we don't interpret it sometimes, we're going to be at a loss.
Okay. With that as a context, knowing what we know now, if we were to write a new constitution today, what should be left in? What should go?
What a great question. You know, I wouldn't change much, I got to say. I would, of course, focus on the Bill of Rights, making sure that that is there first and foremost, because without those things, we don't have political life. We don't have personal life. We don't have any kind of intellectual life. And I want separation of powers to be part of it. I think, you know, we might end up considering some of the things that have shown up in our legislative and executive practices that are not in the Constitution, things like the filibuster, things like executive orders. These things were never considered. The whole administrative state, government agencies that didn't exist until the Great Depression and the 30s, these things weren't really considered at all. When the Constitution was written and ratified, and it would be important to consider how those fit into the system if we were writing it today. The other thing that was never thought about was political parties, you know, and that has become, of course, almost right after the Constitution was ratified, so much a part of our landscape.
Finally, the first three words of the Constitution, we the people, they might be more famous than the starting words of any other document, with the exception of maybe the Bible. In the beginning. Is that an American-centric sort of perspective, or do you think there's a worldwide understanding, grasp, appreciation the importance of those three words.
Well, Kevin, if you put it in historical context, the idea of we the people proclaiming our government was revolutionary. It was so different than all of the other places on our country's empires in which we the people were not what counted. It was he or she, the queen or king. And that made us different right there and has been the object of imitation over and over and over. And now any new countries coming onto the scene, and they do from time to time, they always start with the idea of the people being sovereign. And that's one of our great gifts to the world.
Tomorrow is Constitution Day. After 224 years, the U.S. Constitution remains an enduring document. David Harris, University of Pittsburgh law professor, thanks so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, a real pleasure.
Transition leads to change, which can lead to anxiety, especially in school. A discussion and your calls for clinical psychologist Kathy Petchel next on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.